Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. Hoo-wah! I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. There is a group called We the Veterans. However, it's not clear what their mission is or how they help veterans. In the past 17 years, I've never heard of them. And since their partner is DHS Secretary Mayorkas, I'm not sure I trust their purpose. They may be planning to place 100,000 of what they refer to as veteran volunteers in certain polling places to take specific actions on Election Day. Their placement will be determined by the Biden campaign. Their plan of action would be more appropriate if we knew into which states they'll be assigned. It also appears that the information posted on their website is misleading. They don't have 100,000 veteran volunteers, and it appears they're hiring 100,000 individuals to work at a polling place on Election Day. Will these non-veterans pose as veterans? I hope someone will investigate who's funding We the Veterans and do a background check on their executive director, Ellen Gustafson, to learn when that information is available. It should be published so that all veterans will know what's going on in the name of veterans. And patriotic listeners, please consider volunteering to work at polling places. We need to keep things honest. Okay, joining me at the 50 caliber microphone today is Marine Vet Skip Coriel. You've been visiting grandkids. How many do you have now, Skip?
Oh, boy, sigh. That's just a tired sigh. That's how many grandkids I have. 19 grandkids, Colonel. 19 and counting, because every month it just keeps going up and up and up. We're going to repopulate the earth, all the Coriels.
That's scary. Okay, here's what we have for you today. On news and comments by the Colonel, I'm going to discuss terrorism and the upcoming Olympics in Paris. Then Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby will contribute his warrant wisdom. Then we'll meet retired Colonel and Mayor Mike Morrow. He's honoring veterans. Then we'll talk with veteran and Congressman Brandon Williams. And then we'll hear about Patriot Mobile and about their support for veterans. And finally, Gil and Skip will review our border and a book.
Hey, troops, please invite your friends to join us at this time on this great radio station. Then head on out to frontlinesoffreedom.com and sign up for our free e-newsletter. And join the conversation at facebook.com/frontlinesoffreedom.
We really do welcome your input to this show. Send us your ideas and comments through our website, frontlinesoffreedom.com, or by Facebook. And now it's time for news and comments by the Colonel. Of course, we'll start with the news. What's first, Skip?
Well, Colonel, haphazard planning and shoddy oversight from Pentagon leadership has subjected thousands of rank-and-file service members to dirty and dangerous living conditions in military barracks, government investigators have found. The 118-page Government Accountability Office report just published documented widespread housing issues, mold, dysfunctional plumbing, no heating in the winter, no air conditioning in the summer. Investigators warn that these conditions risk undermining the military's readiness and morale. GAO officials visited barracks at 10 different military installations. Service members at 5 of them reported regular water issues. 4 installations reported broken or malfunctioning fire safety infrastructure. All 10 reported mold infestations and broken malfunctioning or non-existent heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. Investigators also documented broken door locks and first floor windows at 3 installations. They observed insufficient lighting, vacant units occupied by unauthorized personnel, or no existing or working security cameras at 7 installations. Maintenance teams tend to be slow or unresponsive.
This is not new. I'm glad it's being looked at again. I hope there will be some serious action taken, not only to fix the issues now and in the future, but also to hold the commanders responsible. When I was a commander, I was responsible for how my troops lived. This is a huge mess, and the senior officers need to pay for the problems.
We're in the process of removing all our forces and equipment from a small base in Niger, and the 500 remaining troops will leave a critical drone base in the West African country in August, ahead of a September 15 deadline set by the new ruling junta. Air Force Major General Kenneth Elkman said that a number of small teams of 10 to 20 U.S. troops, including special operations forces, have moved to other countries in West Africa, but the bulk of the forces will go to Europe. Niger's ouster of our troops following a coup last year has broad ramifications for us because it's forcing us to abandon the critical drone base that was used for counterterrorism missions in the Sahel, a vast region south of the Sahara Desert where groups linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State operate. Ekman and other leaders have said other West African nations want to work with us and may be open to an expanded American presence. He didn't detail the locations, but some have indicated the Ivory Coast and Ghana as examples. Ekman, the Director for Strategy at U.S. Africa Command, is leading our military withdrawal from the small base at the airport in Niger's capital of Niamey and from the larger counterterrorism base in the city of Agadez. Under the junta agreement, two-thirds of our troops and equipment must be out of the country by July 26. That deadline, which forced us to move quickly, is a key reason why U.S. Africa Command will complete its withdrawal of all 1,000 troops from Niger early. But it also leaves a counterterrorism gap that our officials are struggling to fill as security threats from extremist groups in the Sahel grow.
This is bad news. Worse news is that Russia will be moving in. It's good that we're talking with other nations about having our forces there. This is tough.
And NATO leaders plan to pledge to keep pouring arms and ammunition into Ukraine at current levels for at least another year, hoping to reassure the war-ravaged country of their ongoing support and show Russian President Putin that they will not walk away. President Biden and his counterparts meet in Washington for a three-day summit to mark the military alliance's 75th anniversary as Russian troops press their advantage along Ukraine's eastern front in the third year of the war. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said NATO's 32 member countries have been spending around $43 billion each year on military equipment for Ukraine since the war began, and that this should be a minimum baseline going forward. Quote, "I expect allies will decide at the summit to sustain this level within the next year," Stoltenberg said. He said the amount would be shared among nations based on their economic growth and that the leaders will review the figure when they meet again in 2025. NATO is desperate to do more for Ukraine, but is struggling to find new ways. Already, NATO allies provide 99% of the military support it gets. Soon, the alliance will manage equipment deliveries, but two red lines remain. No NATO membership until the war is over, and no NATO boots on the ground there.
This is an accurate report. Ukraine should not be granted NATO membership while this war is going on, or that will mean all NATO members must be fighting in the war. Not mentioned is that we provide a huge portion of the aid to Ukraine, and European nations should be doing more.
And Philippine forces will defend themselves with the same level of force if they come under assault again from China's Coast Guard in a disputed South China Sea, where Chinese personnel armed with machetes and spears injured Filipino Navy personnel and damaged two of their boats in a chaotic face-off last month, said the Philippine military chief. Armed forces of the Philippines Chief General Romeo Brauner Jr. asked China to pay $1 million in damages for the two Navy boats and return seven rifles, which he said were seized by Chinese Coast Guard personnel during the June 17 confrontation at Second Thomas Shoal. Philippine officials relayed the demands, along with a strong protest, during talks with a Chinese government delegation in Manila. The Chinese delegation did not immediately respond to the demands.
It's good that the Philippines are standing up like that. We need to support them and stand with them. And that's the news. As Americans, it's our responsibility to ensure that our nation is well-run and on the right path. Politics and politicians are confusing, but we can work together. Concerned Veterans for America can assist you, even if you're not a vet, in helping get our nation back on track. Working with them is one of the things I do. Check out cvafrontlines.com. That's cvafrontlines.com. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. Coming up on Frontlines of Freedom, I'll share comments by the Colonel and we'll enjoy some warrant wisdom. Then we'll talk with retired Colonel and Mayor Mike Morrow. At ease, troops, take a break. In business for over 30 years with over $1 billion in sales, Universal Coin and Bullion is my go-to source for gold and silver coins And right now, they're offering our listeners a newly minted 0.99 fine 1 ounce 2024 silver American Eagle coin for just $27. Call 800-UCB-GOLD, 800-UCB-GOLD, or go to their website at universalcoin.com/Denny.
This is Marine Vet Skip Coriel with your home defense tip of the week. A loyal dog can be a useful force multiplier when it comes to home defense. They have keen hearing and sense of smell and will likely sense danger before their human counterparts. A large, obedient, and well-trained dog can deter and even delay an attacker, giving you time to get to your gun. Even a small dog will provide advanced warning and possibly save the lives of yourselves and the ones you love. For more useful tips on home and personal defense, visit homedefenseshow.com.
HelpVet.net is a national help center helping the military community with all of your everyday needs. Whether you need a realtor, an attorney, health-related services, or information on retirement planning, financial resources, or more, our vast network of hand-picked qualified service providers are waiting to help you. With up-to-date military news and resources, you can find answers to all of your daily needs at HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net wants to thank you for your service, and may God continue to bless the U.S. of A.
Do you have a story inside you yearning to come out? As a self-published author, you are free to creatively distribute your book online or using your own professional connections. White Feather Press will publish your manuscript and set up online distribution, allowing the author to retain all copyright and distribution rights as well as all profits. Check out White Feather Press at publishyourdream.com. White Feather Press, reaffirming faith in God, family, and country. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. It is 20 minutes after the hour, and you're in formation listening to the front lines of freedom all across America. Troops, even if our economy wasn't a mess with inflation going crazy and prices going up out of sight, I'd still recommend that you do some investing in precious metals like gold and silver. I encourage you to join me in purchasing these solid investments from Universal Coin and Bullion. Find them at universalcoin.com/Denny. That's universalcoin.com/Denny. Okay, now it's time for comments by the Colonel. Later this month, the nation of France will be hosting the Olympics in Paris. To make an understatement, they are reasonably taking extreme precautions to protect the games and the observers. They've identified three big threats. The first threat is not Islamic terrorists. They're number three. Number one is the disruption of the games by youth riots, protests, or strikes by unions. These are France's traditional summer pastimes. I'd hope that the Parisian police know how to deal with those. Number two is cyber attacks, which are getting more and more common all around the world. During the past summer games in Japan in 2021, the cybersecurity teams reported 450 million attempted attacks, several of which nearly shut the games down even before they began. And that was before artificial intelligence. And the French experts say they expect 8 to 12 times that number this year. 8 to 12 times 450 million? Wow. The primary threat is Russia, who was banned from the games reasonably because of their ongoing attack on Ukraine. Russia is really good at, for example, disinformation campaigns. We've seen a lot of them. One of the reasons Russia can afford to attack other nations in various ways is because they're selling a lot of oil. Our nation pushed Europe to refuse the Nord Stream pipeline that brought oil from Russia into Germany and Western Europe and money from Europe to Russia, but our current administration backed off that. It is true that now Germany has figured out that was a bad choice. Okay, threat number three is, yes, Islamic terrorism. The major supporter of this terrorism is Iran, no surprise. So Iran can afford to do this because our nation, after we had refused to allow Iran to do business, we backed off and now Iran is selling oil and rolling in money, so therefore the terrorists are too. According to the French officials, some 35,000 police, 10 times the normal number on duty at one time, will patrol the games in the adjoining areas, subways, train stations, and the like. Snipers and bomb-sniffing dogs will be located in appropriate places. They'll be supported by 18,000 military personnel and 2,200 foreign police from 46 countries. France did request these reinforcements. American law enforcement will be there. The New York Police Department will send four dogs and handlers. And for several years, the NYPD has had a bilingual officer embedded in the Paris Police Department. The Los Angeles Sheriff's Department is sending 10 dogs and handlers, and the City of Los Angeles Police is sending another 10. For the past 18 months, both city and national SWAT teams have been conducting tabletop exercises and drills designed to spot vulnerabilities. But the heart of the effort is actions the public will never see. French intelligence began watching individuals and groups considered potentially problematic. Visitors who terrorism experts consider suspicious are being identified and surveilled. Individuals even peripherally associated with earlier terrorist events are watched. Airbnb rentals are examined. Social media posts are monitored, this with our government's assistance. Quote, France's intelligence commitment is very impressive, said one of our police officers. There's a major focus on the opening ceremony, which will be attended by 120 heads of state. And for the first time, the ceremony is being held not in a stadium, but on the River Seine, that beautiful river that cuts through the heart of Paris. The athletes will board boats and float down the Seine. This is some 300,000 guests watch on both banks of the river. France was originally planning on to have 500,000 guests on the banks, but it cut it back because of the significant threats. The people who live or work near the river have been screened. Metro stops have been closed, and all cars will be barred from the protected zone for 8 days before the games begin. On the night of the ceremony, France will close the airspace over and around Paris for about 90 miles. All Paris's airports will be closed. Firefighters and private security people will be involved. This is a very good security plan, but one can never be sure. They're clearly doing all they can do to deal with the bad guys out there. I'm sure the terrorists know, at least generally, what the police and security people are doing and are planning ways to get around them. Hey, being on the defense is much harder than being on the offense in this kind of a situation. In my opinion, the real threat is the Islamic terrorists. We know who many of them are, like Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah, and the other groups, not just to make the Olympics more secure, but to deal with the evil people who want to and live lives dedicated to killing other people. Why don't we just take them out, or at least hit them very hard now in every place that we know they are? That could make the world more secure. Yes, preemptive strikes now will certainly cause a lot of condemnation by other nations, and certainly by the UN, but it will show the world that we know good from evil and will attack evil. And since terrorists live to kill others, taking them out, along with anyone who supports them, is not a bad idea. At one time, a few decades ago, we were seen as the world's cop. We dealt with the bad guy nations wherever they were, and back then when we had a very effective and combat-ready military, which we don't seem to have now, but we, or France, could take a step in the right direction and attack the terrorists if we had good leadership. And those are my comments for today. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. You're listening to Frontlines of Freedom. Now we get to enjoy some warrant wisdom with Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. What do you have this week, Roland?
You know, Boeing recently entered into a plea deal with the government to settle its criminal charges over the 2018 and 2019 737 MAX crashes, which in theory could cause major issues with their large military contracts. However, most don't think it will have an impact. You know, the U.S. military is not supposed to deal with companies that have criminal convictions, but the government can waive that. The Air Force has said they will review the company's plans and its agreement with the Department of Justice and determine what steps are necessary and appropriate to protect the federal government. And Canada is also revealing its deal with Boeing to buy P-8 Poseidons. After pleading guilty to conspiracy to defraud the U.S., Boeing has agreed to pay $244 million in fines and invest at least another $455 million in compliance and safety programs. I'm not sure exactly what that means. The families of the victims, however, have complained that Boeing has been given a sweetheart of a deal. You see, the families were calling for $24 billion in fines. And of course, this few hundred million is a far cry from that. You know, Boeing has run into a number of issues recently, from its terrible contract on the new Air Force One 747 to the cancellation from multiple airlines for more aircraft. About 32% of Boeing's revenue comes from defense contracts, or it's about $25 billion a year. In comparison, 43% of their overall revenue comes from commercial aircraft, which is certainly getting a lot of black eyes recently. Can you imagine if the U.S. government was to cancel their contracts with Boeing? The U.S. government is Boeing's single largest customer. And in 2020, 21% of the entire Department of Defense procurement budget went to Boeing. So let's hope they get their stuff together, as Boeing is certainly an important part of our national defense. For Frontlines of Freedom, I'm Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. Back to you, Colonel.
Thanks, Roland. I really appreciate you. Straight ahead on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll meet retired Army Colonel and Mayor Mike Morrow. Then we'll talk with Navy vet and Congressman Brandon Williams. All this is coming up. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. You're standing tall with the Frontlines of Freedom. I'll be right back. Troops, it's time for sit-ups. Do 50, then stand at ease.
Veterans swore an oath to defend this country, and that oath doesn't expire when we take off the uniform.
Concerned Veterans for America provides veterans and military families the opportunity to continue serving their country by taking on the most important issues our country is facing.
A better foreign policy, quality health care for veterans, responsible spending, and more.
Learn more about how you can play a part by visiting cvafrontlines.com. That's cvafrontlines.com.
Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code. Troops, welcome back to our nation's largest military veteran talk radio show, Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Troops, please do send me your comments and questions. Email me through frontlinesoffreedom.com. So it's an honor to welcome to the show retired U.S. Army Colonel Mike Morrow, who is presently the mayor of Gratton, Illinois. Mike and his city is in the process of honoring and supporting our veterans. So welcome, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Denny. It's my honor to be on your show.
Mike, start by telling us about your time in the Army. When and why did you join?
Well, you know, it started when I was a little kid because I always enjoyed the Army. I love those movies about where they had Army guys in them. Remember the, just watching how they did Invaders from Mars with the Army guys. And all.
Yeah.
Oh, that was a good one. And the War of the Worlds where, you know, Gene Hackman was fighting all these guys and the Army comes out to save him. So as I got older, that never really left me. And then, but at some point I graduated high school. And I wanted to go into at least get a start of a college degree. So I went and got a 2-year degree in mechanical design technology from our local school. And while I was doing that, I was working for the city of Flint at the water department full time and working school full time. So I was a pretty busy guy. And I noticed that all the people around me pretty much in the water department and that were veterans. You know, Vietnam was pretty hot right then. This was right in 1970, 69, I graduated. And so I was, you know, influenced by them, basically, and looking at how they carried themselves, the honor and so forth, and the camaraderie that they had. So when it came time for me to make my decision, I finished my 2-year degree and I said, it's time to go. I went and joined, went down to the recruiter's office in July of 71 and I joined the United States Army.
So you enlisted to do what?
I enlisted to be an engineer because they went in and the recruiter talked to me and he says, hey, he says, you know, you've got this degree in mechanical design. He says, you've been working for the city of Flint. And my boss in the city, I was a draftsman. And he taught me how to survey. So I was a surveyor. I mean, not licensed or anything, but I knew how to do it.
Uh-huh.
And so they sent me to Detroit for an interview with a full colonel who was at that time, I didn't realize it, but he's with the Corps of Engineers with the Detroit District. And so I interviewed with him and the sergeant that sent me down there, he says, we got this program. You can come in as a Spec 4. And I said, ooh, that sounds good. So I went down there not knowing what a Spec 4 was, and the colonel interviewed me and asked me a lot of questions and on surveying and everything else. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. He says, I'm going to let you come in as a Spec 5. And he started writing this down. I go, whoa, whoa, whoa. And he said, what? And I says, the sergeant said I could be a Spec 4. And he laughed because I thought I was getting hosed, you know. And he's, no, he said, trust me, kid, this is better. So I went back to the recruiter, and lo and behold, he was ecstatic. He said, "Oh my gosh, Spec 5, this is great. You can go in." And so they wrote that up, and it was called the Shake and Bake program in the Army. And I went through that, and after graduating basic training, I was promoted to Spec 5. That was a hell holdover because my school was canceled at that point. They gave me two options. They said, "Well, you can get out." And I said, "I just got in. I don't want to get out." I says, "Or you can go to NCOES at Fort Belvoir, Virginia," which was non-commissioned officer schools, 9 months. And I said, "I guess I'll do that." So I did.
So you started out at the bottom and moved quickly into the non-commissioned officer range.
Well, you know, it's like you take a private one day and you pin Spec 5 on him the next day, which is back in those days, it was an E5.
Yes.
I don't know what to do. So they sent me to school to learn that. And then my first duty assignment was the day we graduated NCOES, the night before, the sergeant major came in, handed everybody the orders. And this was in 72. And my orders read, "Go to Vietnam." And so the next morning when he came through, he goes, "Oh," pulled all those orders back. He said, "These are all being rescinded. You're all getting new orders." And I was going to the 25th Infantry Division at Schofield Barracks in Hawaii. And so that was my first duty assignment.
That has to be a really tough place to go.
Well, I thought so. I mean, you know, actually, you think about it, I was there for 3 years, and about the second year you get homesick. I couldn't afford to fly home. And I didn't really have a girlfriend at the time, but, you know, my mom and dad were still there. And I remember standing on the beach in the wintertime over there in my shorts, enjoying life and thinking, "Where's the snow?" But it was a good assignment. I mean, I was with the 25th Infantry Division. I was with the 65th Combat Engineer Battalion, which was their motto was first in and last out.
Okay. Well, obviously, you didn't stay in that capacity because you became a commissioned officer.
Yeah, well, yes. But what happened first, though, is I was over there for less than a year, and I went to my sergeant major, pushed me in front of the promotion board, and he said, "Believe it or not, you're eligible to go." So I went before the promotion board, and my points were such that I got promoted to staff sergeant within less than 2 years. And so I was a platoon sergeant over there, enjoyed it. I left from there and then went over to the 864th in the States. And my command sergeant major there, you know, he called me one day and he says, "You know," he says, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean, sergeant major? You called me." He goes, No. He says, "I mean, what are you doing here? You need to be going to officer candidate school." He said, "You got a lot on the ball. You've got a sharp," and so forth. So he pushed me. I took my tests and everything and passed all those. And, you know, the rest, as they say, was history. I went off to OCS. But one of the things I realized that when I was in the Army is that we had what were called mentors. I always found that I had a mentor that was there to help me through the process, help guide me, help make those proper decisions. And so God bless Sergeant Major Stone, who's long passed now, but he was the one that got me into officer candidate school.
Well, you know, there's a great deal of sense in that, isn't there?
There is.
When you see people with ability and the right attitude, you want to encourage them on. That doesn't happen enough, I don't think.
I can't speak for today. That's been a long time, but I think the same thing goes on today with the Army. I hope it does and trust it does. Same thing in civilian life. I mean, if you see somebody that needs help, you help them out. And that's not always the case, but I found for me it was.
Well, that's what real leadership involves. That's not all there is to real leadership, but that's certainly a big part of it, isn't it?
That is absolutely one of those. And that's one of those that you learn from people's example. Now, don't do as I say, you know, do as I'm doing. Follow me. And that was our motto in the 65th Combat Engineer Battalion was follow me. 65th was first in, last out. So, yes, we had a lot of leaders you can look back on. And I'll tell you, we still remember their names. You know, Sergeant Major Stone, Sergeant Sturgis, Sergeant Miller, my two drill sergeants. I mean, those guys are embedded in my memory, and I'll probably remember them to the day I die.
Okay. We've got a few minutes left. You went to officer's candidate school,
yes.
Came out as second lieutenant, and did what?
My first assignment was a training officer, and that lasted for about 3 months down at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, and then I was made as a second lieutenant, a company commander of a basic training unit. And I loved that and did that for a while. And then from that position, I went straight on to be the deputy commanding general's aide de camp for the post. finished up there, went through regular things through officer school. I was a captain. I commanded a company in Germany, and I made major. Went to all the different courses that you have to go through, and I was a battalion commander. Got picked below the zone for lieutenant colonel. Made battalion command with the in down at Fort Stewart, and mechanized, and I love that. And then was promoted to 06, and then for my brigade command, I was given a district, the St. Louis district, with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And I fought that tooth and nail because I said, you got to be kidding me, guys. I've been on the combat side my whole life. And, you know, and in between there, I deployed to Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and a bunch of other things, little flare-ups that we had here and there. And I says, I'd really like to go back to Fort Stewart and be a brigade commander of the 25th or 24th MEC. And they said, no, you're going to the St. Louis district. They said, trust us, you'll like it. Well, I got there as a district commander for the St. Louis district. Now, remember that first colonel that interviewed me, he was a district commander in Detroit. So I basically had his job. And I'm up in St. Louis. I had 1,000 civilians. Yet the only other military I had was my deputy, who was a major. And I had this responsibility for Illinois, Missouri, the waterways, the 350 miles of the Mississippi River, 6 locks and dams on the main stem of Mississippi, 1 on the Kaskaskia River, 5 lakes with dams for flood control. I had a power plant on the lake up in Missouri, and we had 44,000 miles of regulated waterways.
We'll continue this conversation when we come back. Mike will stay with us. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Front Lines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for push-ups. I want you to do 103. That's how many I used to do before I got into my 80s. But then take a break and stay in the area. Mike and I will be right back.
Friends, Adam here, Patriot Foods, U.S. only company. Frozen fruits and vegetables straight from our dirt, not overseas. Support the U.S. farmer when you shop at patriotfoods.com. We give back to a military family in need. We got to take care of each other, my friends. We have to. So important. 10% off patriotfoods.com. 10% off promo code FREEDOM and shop today.
It's that time of the year again. The U.S. Mint is making their new 2024 American Silver Eagle and American Gold Eagle coins, and there's no better time to shore up your investment in precious metals than now. Call Universal Coin and Bullion at 800 UCB Gold to get great prices on the finest gold and silver coins of the year. I work with Universal Coin and Bullion because they're a company that you can trust. So give them a call at 800 UCB Gold. That's 800 UCB Gold, or check them out at universalcoin.com/Denny. This is Colonel Danny Gillum. This is the final formation for this hour on Front Lines of Freedom. Continue our conversation with Colonel and Mayor Mike Morrow. Okay, Mike, so you suddenly were running
a civilian district at basically the Corps of Engineers, and I loved it for 3 years. I did all the regulation, did all of that. Then the Twin Towers were hit, and I was asked to be the CENTCOM engineer for the Afghanistan-Iraq War. I went over as General Tommy Frank's engineer, and I did that for a year, and then I did the reconstruction for a year, and then I came back and retired. And in my civilian career, I was started doing consulting, but I was also picked up as the president of an aviation manufacturing company, did that for about 6 years, South Carolina and here in Illinois, and then retired and then ended up as the mayor of Grafton, Illinois.
Yeah. What encouraged you to run for mayor? What was it that got your attention?
Well, I actually ran 2 times before, and once because I was asked, and you know, and it didn't really have my heart into it, and didn't have a campaign or anything, and you know, lost. And so this last time, I didn't want to run, and I had some people come to me and they say that we need you to run. There's a lot of things that are going on in town that need to be fixed. And I said, only if I get the backing. So I did. We had the backing, had a campaign, we ran. And I ran on 3 things. First one was, I will not take a salary. I will donate my salary back to the police department or whoever needs it. And I write that check every month. Second one was that I will get the ferry we'll do a study and try to get that running. We have a ferry across the Mississippi. Try to get that running instead of just on the weekends, but maybe extend it into 7 days. And we're getting ready to close on that on the end of this month. And the third thing was look for a way to honor our veterans, because Grafton has the highest percent of veterans at 17% per capita in the state of Illinois.
Okay, well, that would certainly ring my bell, too, if I were there. Lots of ways to do that. What did you come up with?
Well, we came up with, I've been to Normandy, France three times, and we were at the 70th and the 75th commemorations. And on the 70th, I was honored to give a speech on D-Day on Omaha Beach to the Bedford Association. And part of all that is going to Point du Hoc, where the 2nd Ranger Battalion, Army Ranger Battalion, climbed the cliffs at Point du Hoc, the 100-foot cliffs, to take out the German guns so that the landings on D-Day between Utah and Omaha Beach could be successful without being in the line of fire. So with that, and when we came back from the 75th, I was driving by the cliffs in Grafton, and my wife was there. I looked up and I said, look, Point du Hoc. And that started it. Then when I became the mayor in May of 21, that fall in December of 22, we established a commission with the council unanimously voted on it. And we've established a commission to look to ways to honor the vets. And taking that vision that we had for the Point du Hoc, because our cliffs here in Grafton along the Mississippi are 100 foot high, and they replicate Point du Hoc. So what we're going to do is we came up with a plan. We get a 501c3 and everything. And we're going to have 12 bronze life-size statues of those Rangers climbing the cliffs, taking out the German positions at replicating Point du Hoc. And it's going to have a museum. We're going to have all different things that go with that. But that's going to be the centerpiece.
That sounds absolutely outstanding.
Well, the foundry that we're using is out of North Carolina. We've got a quarry that's going to be in Missouri, and they're going to do the obelisks. But to do the foundry, we picked North Carolina and North Carolina bronze. And when we were on a phone call interview with them for the final interview, I looked at the wife's owner said, well, are we going to be your foundry? And I looked at the architect and he shook his head yes. And I said, yes, you are. We like what we hear. And she said, well, good. Because we've done our homework, and there is no other project like this in the entire world. And we want on board.
Whoa.
So I was literally taken back at that. And I said, really? And they said, no, 12, you know, life-size statues, climbing the cliffs, Point du Hoc. This is one of a kind. So we're excited with that. And we've been having people jump on board, our engineers here in town, the SMS Engineer Company. They've done all of our engineering for free. We've got a project manager donating his project time. We've had, it's just been amazing how snowball and how quickly this has grown to where we are today. The first week of June, we had the foundry come out this year, and they did the live scanning for the models, for the statues. Now, to make a life-size bronze statue, the process takes 2 years because you go through the Wass Wax method and everything. Well, we got 12 of them. So we said, this isn't going to work. So what they said was that we're going to be doing with new technology. We will come out, we'll take these live models, and we'll scan them. We'll take that scan, and we'll take it to a digital printer, and then from there, we go to the foundry process. And we'll give you a year of our floor time to do all 12 at once.
Wow.
So to make that happen, though, we've got to have the uniforms and everything with that. So in comes the 2nd Ranger Battalion of St. Louis, which is a historic reenactment group, and they reenact Point du Hoc. Now, I don't know, how does all these align up? You know, how does all this stuff come together? Because it's just amazing. But I was at a dinner in December of 22, right after we did the commission. My wife couldn't come. I'm there by myself. It's a boring dinner in St. Louis, you know, one of these mayor's things. And there's this other woman sitting across the table. Her husband wasn't there. So we just started chatting. And I said, what's your husband do? And she goes, oh, he does this, but he's a reenactor. I said, oh, well, what's he reenact? He reenacts Point du Hoc. I said, you got to be kidding. So from there, I met John Petrosinski. He's a retired master sergeant out of the Air Force. And he, with his group, have been with us since the start, And they come out and they had all the uniforms, the equipment, the period gear, and they made sure that everyone that we had selected for models, active duty Rangers and civilians that were of that same age group of the young men, that they were dressed in period uniform, they had the correct weapons, and we had all the positions as they went through that taken care of. So it was a great, great opportunity that we did through in June here this year.
So when will all this be done?
Well, we're shooting for our target date of 6/6/26. And of course, that's going to be dependent upon funding, but we're working well hard with that. And, you know, everybody can come on board. We've got a founding sponsor member program, which if you want to be a founding sponsor, we're only going to accept 5,000 of those. That's $1,000. Go onto our website. And it is the graftonmemorial.org. And then you'll see where you can donate.
Mike, we're about out of time.
All right.
One more time. To donate or just to learn more, what's the website?
graftonmemorial.org. G-R-A-F-T-O-N memorial.org.
This is awesome. And folks, if you can't remember that, Denny at frontlinesoffreedom.com, I can get Mike for you. No problem. Mike, thank you. Thank you for these great comments, for what you're doing and your community's doing and support of our nation. Wow. All I can say is I'm going to try to be there when you do this, because this is just fantastic. It's amazing.
Thank you, Denny. And thank you all your listeners and the folks that are out there right now. We'd love your donations, and God bless you.
Thank you, sir. This concludes the first hour of the show. We'll start the second hour talking with veteran Congressman Brandon Williams. Then we'll learn about how Patriot Mobile honors veterans. And then Gil and Skip will discuss the border in a book. Of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag, military history, and a self-defense report. This is Colonel Denny Gilliam on Front Lines of Freedom. Groups, it's time for pull-ups. Do 40 good ones, maybe 20 more push-ups. Grab some protein, rehydrate with water. And finally, put a big smile on your proud-to-be-an-American face and send me your thoughts by email or on Facebook.